dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, of the 1950s understood the importance of ideas. They devoted a great deal of their energies toward purging the mass media and academia of what they considered to be the communist threat. Now, these communists and leftists were not agents of foreign governments, but Americans, people who objected to a society ruled by the rich and organized to be the engine of their profit-making activities rather than the general welfare. These opponents of plutocracy were exercising their supposed rights to freedom of thought and association, the shallowness of which was revealed by the activities of HUAC. The people who were hounded from their livelihoods during the HUAC period were armed only with words and thoughts, but were dangerous because they were in positions that enabled them to carry their thoughts to mass audiences in the case of the media workers, and to future members of the professional class in the case of academics. The First Amendment protects citizens from government abridgment of speech and association, at least in theory, but it does not protect us from censorship by the so-called private sector, where we work, and it is in this area where the pressure to submit is brought to bear. The threat is the loss of the ability to make a livelihood. A very real threat if a worker is known by the boss to be involved with radical politics. This is not fantasy. As a person who previously worked at a community radio station in California renowned for its radical views, many contributors said they didn't want public acknowledgement of their donations to the station because they feared to lose their jobs. And this wasn't during the HUAC period either. It was the 1990s. Some people are able to escape ideological coercion while working for a living, but most are not, as more and more people are compelled to earn a living as employees of large corporations. Some of those, like Walmart, give extensive personality tests to applicants that weed out all but the most willing to submit to absolute managerial authority, as has been documented by Barbara Ehrenreich in her book Nickel and Dimed, published in 2002. And this brings us to our so-called free press. There is a famous maxim that freedom of the press belongs to he who owns the press. And the truth of this can be demonstrated by the fact that although a diversity of political views exist in America, these views are not represented in our mass media. A program like this one is very much the exception, as you are probably quite aware. In this light, I'd like to begin the program by providing a perspective on the removal this week of shock jock Howard Stern from six stations of the more than 1,200 station Clear Channel Radio Empire. Stern's brand of crass confrontationalism has spawned many imitators over the years on the airwaves. There is no shortage of such radio talk show personalities, and every so often there's an uproar when one of these shock jocks gets a bit too offensive. Although Stern and his imitators have been fined for their sexually crude material by the FCC on various occasions, in 1995, Stern's syndicators paid $1.7 million in fines. The wealthy corporations who employ them continue the broadcasts because these broadcasts are popular and attract a host of ears that can then be filled with a commercial message of the sponsors that provide the revenue for the media corporations. These shock jock broadcasts are popular with some, I think, because they provide an outlet for expressions of anger and rebellion but in a way that doesn't challenge the powers that be. Because they attack social and sexual taboos, normally picking on defenseless targets rather than attack the powerful and their economic structures. Meanwhile, enter the Janet Jackson Super Bowl nipple flash. The FCC, whose members tend to serve the same class interests as most of the rest of the government, is coming under increasing fire for its giveaway of the allegedly public broadcast spectrum to be the money machines of a few giant corporations who strive to dominate the arena of culture and discourse in the interest of their bottom lines. These media empires are devoted to consumerism and profit-making as the essence of Americanness. CBS, the network upon which the shocking bare breast appeared, had recently declined to air during that very same Super Bowl broadcast a public service announcement criticizing the record deficit in which the Bush administration has plunged several generations of Americans. This PSA, showing children performing tedious work to demonstrate on whose back those debts must be repaid, was deemed inappropriate and refused airing, even though the organization attempting to air the PSA, MoveOn.org, had raised the $1.7 million fee demanded by CBS to air a 30-second spot during the Super Bowl. Yet PSAs made by the Bush White House, however, were not considered too controversial, nor was a halftime routine that featured stylized violence against women, during which the bit of bare breast was inadvertently displayed. And CBS is one of the media corporations advocating the FCC rule change that would allow it to increase its media empire by lifting the caps on how many stations one company could own. To deflect government culpability for the corporate giveaway of the airwaves that has destroyed localism, which is often mentioned, as well as access to the airwaves for critics of the system, which is not often mentioned, we are now witnessing once again an orgy of concern over sexually explicit material on the airwaves. Also under attack by Democratic media forces has been the radio giant Clear Channel, which owns not only more than 1,200 radio stations, but also a host of concert venues in major cities. Clear Channel is the same organization that banned the Dixie Chicks after they criticized Bush, sponsored pro-war rallies complete with Clear Channel-provided flags for participants to wave, and also banned the airplay of a long list of songs that included such classics as Imagine by John Lennon in the wake of September 11th. Clear Channel is based in San Antonio, Texas, and its owners have contributed more than $500,000 to the Bush campaign. It was Clear Channel that pulled Howard Stern's syndicated program from six of its stations this week, citing sexually inappropriate material in a broadcast. And this is how the story is being reported in the mainstream press. However, some people who have been following the controversy and who are familiar with Stern's broadcasts have noted that lately Stern has been speaking openly against Bush and calling for his removal from office. According to a report on the website edvert.com, in the week preceding his cancellation, Stern started, quote, ranting on the government in general and Bush in particular, saying he'd never vote for him. He reviewed Al Franken's book, saying how great it was. Those kids from Harvard did all this research, and you'd never vote for Bush after reading it. He said that the Republicans are irrational. They want the economy to be Clinton's, but the military to be Bush's. He's become an anybody-but-Bush guy and is defending Kerry. Close quote. Another observer noted, along the same lines, that one of the stations from which Stern was removed on February 25th was in Louisville, Kentucky, which also was, the following day, the site of a Bush campaign visit touting his economic policies. The Associated Press described the visit as two carefully orchestrated and supporter-stocked appearances that nevertheless failed to convince some of the voters present. Kentucky is considered a swing state in the 2004 election contest. So, was Stern fired for vulgarity or politics? You decide. Tonight on the program, how mental subordination is enforced in and by our opinion-forming social institutions. We begin with this report from Clayton Dewey in Durango, Colorado.
The state of Colorado seems to have become an unlikely battleground for free speech issues in higher education. It was in 2001 that Fort Lewis College was thrust into the limelight when the administration prohibited English professor Michelle Malik from teaching a class on pornography. Since then, Colorado legislature has entertained the idea of an academic bill of rights, which, amongst other things, would require the hiring of more politically conservative professors on campus, an idea popularized by the notorious David Horowitz, one-time radical communist, now turned radical conservative. Horowitz included several Colorado campuses in his speaking tour to combat what he calls indoctrination centers for the political left. The state legislature is considering another bill. This one would ban any discussion of controversial issues not explicitly addressed in class syllabi. And so it seems appropriate that the battle continues once again in Durango, Colorado. The class itself is also fitting, a course entitled Deconstructing Systems in the Pursuit of Anarchy. Mark Cease, instructor of the course, explains the class as this.
The course was originally sort of designed as a way to understand the sort of foundations of systems by seeing how systems are deconstructed. And that is largely what many of the intellectuals who are associated with the anarchist movement have done throughout history. And we have a strong movement here in the United States, one that isn't often talked about. The course was also designed to do away with a lot of misconceptions about anarchy in general and what it means.
Fort Lewis senior Josh Rankin, one of the students in the class, talked about some of those misconceptions.
I was actually hitchhiking up to school this semester, and somebody picked me up, and she asked, you know, what class I was going to, kind of chit-chat, and I said I was going to anarchy, and she got this, like, really panic-stricken look on her face, and she was like, you mean devil worshipping? And I'm like, well, that's not exactly what anarchy is, and kind of explained or gave a brief explanation of what I thought anarchy was, but it was really funny. So I don't know if she pictured us in some kind of cult, like sitting there with Mark sacrificing a goat in front of the class.
Cease said this about what he feels the true meaning of anarchy is.
In popular culture, it's sort of demonized as chaos and disorder, and anybody who looks deeply into anarchy in terms of a study realizes that it's much more than, that it has really nothing to do with chaos and disorder. It's more or less built on the idea of order, but a natural human order that emerges amongst humans.
And so in putting these ideas of deconstructing systems into practice, the students of the class unanimously, with one abstention, decided that they would not comply with a certain component of the evaluation process for general studies courses. Rachel Stryker, the sociology department's representative on the General Education Council, described the policy in contention.
In addition to a general survey and a set of student evaluations, that we have added a new piece to the evaluation process, which is that you, as a professor, once you've taught a TS2 class, are required to submit student papers, certain student papers. So you pick randomly, you know, numbers 3, 8, 11, and 24, and you pick a paper that those students have written, and then you turn them in with your evaluations.
The students and professor of the anarchy class signed and sent a memo to the General Studies Council listing the various reasons for their decision not to hand over their papers. Cease pointed out that there are many other hoops that must be jumped through for the class to be approved in the first place. As a professor, he is wary of what could really be done with this additional form of oversight.
There's been a lot of concerns among many of the faculty of the sort of mechanism of assessment that's being used, and because it can't possibly measure what it is it's designed to do. So many people are seeing it as sort of it could be used as a sort of a tool to, you know, single out particular faculty, or it could be used as a sort of device that would be used as a sort of thought police sort of system.
Gary Giannini, chair of the General Education Council, took issue with the charge of the policy being a form of thought police.
There's nothing in here that goes in that goes back to evaluating whether professors should get tenure or promotion. The privacy thing for looking at students' papers, we white out all the names that are in the paper, both in who wrote it, and then if a person's name came up in it who was a member of our college community or anything like that, that goes out.
Still, Rankin and other students had additional concerns about the policy. Rankin elaborated on some of these points.
Somebody like an outsider who wasn't in the class and didn't do the readings and didn't participate in any of these discussions had no real way of assessing what we actually learned throughout the semester. And so we didn't believe they had any business taking a portion of our work and looking at it and from that assessing whether it was going to be a class that they would teach again. And I mean, one of the titles of the class is Deconstructing Systems is the first part of it, so it seemed kind of appropriate that none of us would play into that and give, if you want to call it a system or administration or this bureaucracy, any of our work, because we had learned all semester that we didn't need kind of that patriarchal force overlooking everything in society, so why would we let them overlook what we were doing in class?
It remains unclear what decision will be made in regards to students' refusal to hand over their papers. Most people see the class's decision being respected, and the class's action will certainly lead to a review of this method of assessment, possibly even the actual removal of the policy. No matter what the outcome of this situation is, those involved in the anarchy class have made it clear that this is not an isolated incident, but part of a larger issue, the issue of free speech in the classroom. Stryker said this.
I feel that it's an incremental drift towards more state intervention into higher education in the forms of surveillance and things like that. I mean, I was just talking to Jim today. It doesn't seem like a coincidence to me, although I might be paranoid, I don't know, that, right now we have a bill that's being introduced in the Colorado legislature that's going to make it basically illegal to talk about politics unless it's determined that it's directly related to the course topic or the course subject matter. So on the one hand, they're determining what we can talk about, and on the other hand, they're creating laws that are going to punish us for talking about what we're going to talk about. And evaluation methods fit into that as well. Because based on evaluation methods, based on standards the state sets, they can determine whether we're good teachers or bad teachers and whether we should have jobs or not as well. Sure. So I do worry that this is part of a larger problem that we should address as faculty together.
Cease shared similar concerns to Stryker.
There's a real ethic of distrust, I think, that has been created in the state of Colorado regarding higher education, and many of the people see that as, from the legislative aspect, see that as a sort of threat to their particular political agendas, and so they're trying, in a way, to discourage, First Amendment rights of open speech and, dialogue and dialogic environments and democratic environments. And I think that this is the real danger and shouldn't be tolerated in a free and open society, if that's in fact what we are.
For Colorado Indie Media, this is Clayton Dewey.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. African Americans are represented in government and other top positions, but conditions for the majority of Black people in America are worse than ever. Poverty, police brutality, and incarceration are visited disproportionately on Black communities. Henry Louis Gates Jr. is the director of the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African American Research at Harvard University. He recently hosted a PBS special based on his book, America Behind the Color Line, Dialogues with African Americans. Tracy James and Gerald Smith are the producers of Slave Revolt Radio, which is heard on Berkeley Liberation Radio and Free Radio Santa Cruz in California. They recently broadcast a critique of the Gates PBS documentary for failing to address some important contexts of the Black liberation struggle and how they've played out in America. Next, an hour-long excerpt of that much longer critique. The first voice you will hear is that of Tracy James, who does the majority of the analysis in the segment I'm playing for you today.
Shameless file time. And the candidate for the shameless file is none other than Professor Henry Louis Gates. This is a Negro professor from one of those Ivy League schools. And recently he's put together a PBS piece called Beyond the Color Line, where he attempts to, in his words at least, examine where black people are in the year 2004. And what more we need to do to accomplish people like Martin King's quote-unquote dream. Well, we're about to explore what that really means for black people, the people throughout the world, and within the context of the crisis of world imperialism that we see playing out. So first off, let's hear Gates do his little introductions to his show, and then we'll go from there. Check this out.
In 1963, the largest civil rights march in history took place in Washington, D.C. Crossing the bridge over the mighty Potomac, heading into Washington, D.C., there's the Lincoln Memorial. Washington is located where it is because it was geographically in the center of the United States, but it really marks the gateway to the South. You know, I was always afraid to go to the South, because the South, for a black person, is the home of racism, the Klan, segregation, but it was also the home of the civil rights movement. And the home of the greatest civil rights leader of all, Dr. Martin Luther King. And it was here that he gave the greatest speech of his life in August of 1963, when he said that, "I have a dream.
We will be able to transform the dangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today."
I'm heading south, something I'd never dreamed I'd do as a child, to find out how the South has changed since Dr. King's assassination in 1968. What's become of his dream of racial integration? Slavery ended in 1865, but life for black people in the South remained a nightmare of poverty and terror. Racial segregation was the law of the land. Black men could be lynched capriciously, arbitrarily. We used to joke that southern cities had a sign that said, "Nigger, read and run. And if you can't read, run anyway." Millions did, fleeing north for a better life. Ironically, a century later, black people in the hundreds of thousands are flocking back. I was in Washington at the site of Dr. King's famous speech to meet a man I hope could explain the surprising development, the actor Morgan Freeman. Morgan was born in Memphis. Like many of his neighbors, his family migrated to Chicago when he was a boy. And yet, despite his wealth and fame, he has chosen to return to the South and make his home in Mississippi.
So people ask me when I went home to live after becoming this major persona, and good Lord,
what is wrong with you?
You can live anywhere in the world you want to. Why you come here? I said, because I can live anywhere in the world I want to. That's why. This is home. This is where my roots are. This is where my parents are buried. This is where I've always felt safest.
But what is it about the South that's different for a black person than the North or the West?
I think we built the South, and we know it. I do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, what I own in the South isn't because I went and bought it. What I own is
my place there. Because my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather, my great-grandmother, my great-grandfather, great-great-grandmother, great-great-grandfather, I mean, all the way back to my great-great-great-grandmother, mm-hmm. who happened to be a Virginian. Hmm. That's where they had the farms. Hmm. Oh, either they already got her off the ship.
Mm-hmm.
But,
right.
Yeah, I don't see that anything traveling around the country and living in different places, I could never see that any place was better racially than Mississippi.
You never experienced racism as a kid in the South?
Yes, of course I did. That's not the point. Whether I experienced racism in the South is not it.
Right.
Is where else did I experience it?
Right, like in the North.
Yeah, you know, it's, I don't care anything about experiencing racism in the South. I don't and won't now.
No, right.
So.
But our image of the South was not of a nurturing place. I mean, the image that I was raised with of the South was the place of the Klan,
yeah.
place of racism.
Yeah, you weren't going to find any less racism.
In the North?
No. It's going to be more insidious and more painful.
Mm.
Because you're given to think that, oh, it's different here.
Mm-hmm. You're free,
boy.
Right,
right.
So you'll be buried there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My mother and father buried right there in front of the house.
Oh, they are?
Oh, yeah.
This is your home place?
Yeah.
Oh, so you went back to your home place.
I went back to home.
Wow, man. Very few of us can do that.
Yeah, that's true. But those of us who can and do will be, I think, will be very pleased in later years when I sit on the front porch with a rocking chair, eat watermelon, fan the flies, and say, why do we give this up?
All right, so you can get an idea. This is kind of an anti-intellectual minstrel performance going on. When Gates talks about how it's ironic that blacks in the hundreds of thousands are flocking back to the South, he's doing this and giving people the impression and pretense that blacks have now found that the South to be something that we did not know before, that somehow now that's the oasis, that's the paradise, as if blacks came north because they were under the illusion that it was some kind of paradise. No, the reality is that aside from brutal Jim Crow and black code terrors that were taking place in the South to engineer black people into mired poverty and deprivation after World War II, especially when the capitalist markets throughout the world in Eastern Europe, you know, France, Germany, and Russia, and where Japan, their industrial base was destroyed. These were the capitalist competitions, competitors to the U.S. And with their industrial bases destroyed, they could no longer produce the cars and the refrigerators, which is what all of this capitalist war and destruction is all about in the first place. Who's going to sell who what refrigerator, and who controls the markets to sell each other the refrigerators, the oil of the world, etc. So the U.S. had a flood of economic production capacity and capabilities, because the other competitors' markets and systems, industrial systems, had been collapsed through imperial wars. So this provided for not just white Americans, but for black folks, a massive opportunity for work. And this is how you saw and why you saw a flooding of black people to the northern industrial cities and to areas where there were opportunities on as longshoremen, Richmond, Oakland, you know, Chicago, etc. I don't even need to go on and on. So basically, there was an opening for opportunity for black folks to work because there was such an abundance of jobs that the same type of mechanism of control that the South had, the North couldn't have, because it needed so much, so many workers. It wasn't that they were any quote-unquote friendlier towards black people or had any kind of more friendly attitude, but after World War II and during World War II, they needed labor. That's how women were able to penetrate into the industry. It wasn't all of a sudden they had a transformation about their attitudes towards women. They needed the labor. So black people seized the opportunity. And most of the opportunity was in the North. Now, once the capitalist markets got back into formation in Japan and Europe, you know, so on and so forth, and they started to put their product back onto the market in the late 60s, early 70s, you've seen a steady decline in wage income of the American workers. And with the U.S. being able to penetrate much of the third world in its Cold World imperial dominance through many vehicles like the School of the Americas, it was able to at the same time find low-wage, high-repression areas. So when the capitalists throughout the world started to compete again, and then the U.S. was trying to drive down the wages of American workers to compete with his capitalist competitors, a way to offset the resistance of the workers in this society was basically to start sending some of those jobs off into South America, since they had imperialized and penetrated and basically banana republicized many of those regions. So it was class warfare. So then you've seen a collapse in many of the urban industrial bases in the North that once existed for black people in the North. So black people being pragmatic and seeing what the hell is going on, if you live in, you know, central LA, and you've seen over the last 25 years some 150 to 200,000 jobs evaporate from the industrial base, and where your grandfather and father were easily able to get jobs working in the industry for cars or whatever, and now those have all gone up in smoke, you may reconsider your options. So the fact that black people are relocating and stuff like that has nothing to do with all of a sudden, you know, the South being some kind of, this is all rhetoric. But it's said in such simplistic terms, without being or even attempting to be analytical. Is this said in this kind of like a Wizard of Oz type of land? Now, then you got Morgan Freeman saying, you know, well, the South is where I've always felt safest. Well, the fact of the matter is if you feel the safest in the South, then that in reality is an indictment on America, because there's no place in America where black people are really safe. And the fact that you could feel safest in any part of America where you still have vicious incidents going on is kind of a, well, let me put it this way. Here you have recently Tulia, Texas. 10% of the black population gets rounded up and thrown into prison off the testimony of one little punk pig, one punk cop. And 10% of the black population is rounded up on these phony drug charges. Then, before that, you had the Mississippi jail lynchings, when all of these blacks were being found dead in their jail cell. Many, or all of them, were being accused of committing suicide. One black person who was supposed to go off to college the next day was found hung. And he had his hands tied behind his back. This is how vicious it is. Now, in Mississippi, where Morgan is now, you have the Jackson Advocate newspaper, this brother who's been putting out the Advocate. And not too long ago, his place got firebombed because they're still they still have the nerve to talk about the plight and injustices that go on for black people in Mississippi and the South. So this whole thing about feeling safe and presenting the South as some kind of quote unquote new South, where Freedman said, "So I don't and won't experience racism now." I mean, this is silly. People who've listened to Slave Revolt have heard me do commentary, for example, a Mississippi Goddamn, where I go into the black church burnings. And the black church burnings were in part predicated on controlling the black vote. They were terrorizing black people, primarily in the South, to control the vote because of the numbers of black people in Mississippi and Alabama and, you know, Georgia, etc. So for this Negro to get up here and just ignore some of this recent history, this vile recent history, is actually nothing but an abomination. So with Freeman winding up saying, now it has many of us thinking, why did we give this up? Well, see, not all black people live on acres and acres of land. Many black people in the South, just like the North, are living in dire poverty. So to focus in on Freeman, a rich actor, we're talking someone who has millions of dollars. For the average person, regardless of what color they are, if you got millions of dollars in your back pocket, yeah, you can live good. I mean, this is silly. Why would you focus in on Freeman? And if you are going to talk to Freeman, why not other people from different economic backgrounds in the South? So this gives you an indication of how simplistic Gates is trying to engineer this and act like, as I said before, blacks are flocking back. You know, it's like, look, even there's the movie called A Raisin in the Sun. It's the old classic movie with Sidney Poitier and all of that. And it takes place in the urban Chicago where, three generations of people are in a Chicago, project. The mother of Sidney, then Sidney, who's the son and father of like an 8-year-old kid, and his wife, and Sidney's sister. They all live in this cramped apartment. And Sidney's trying to do various maneuvers to pursue his dream. He's basically a chauffeur, and he wants to try to invest money in different things like that that has been given to the mother from the father who passed away. So she got some kind of inheritance, and Sidney wants to invest it. And she doesn't want to invest it like he does. She, and put it into any kind of business like a bar or anything. She just wants to buy a home or something stable like that. And Sidney says to her, why are you trying to stop me from my dreams? When you and father came here, came to the north from the South, you were trying to pursue your dreams, didn't you? And then you saw that it wasn't much different in the North than it was in the South. So, in other words, my whole point, this movie was made like in the 50s. Black people were already talking about that then. We weren't in any kind of illusion about what the hell was going on in Mississippi, Chicago, Mississippi, Oakland, Mississippi, L.A., or Mississippi, Alabama. It's all Sam's Plantation. We're just trying to navigate our way through it. So to get into all of this little, superficial rhetoric, and you've even had movies, like classic movies like Raisin in the Sun, which just about every black person is seen on the planet, or at least in America, North America, it's just a joke. And then, as far as them talking about we have an image of the South not being very nurturing, as if implying that we had an image of the North being nurturing. Look, once again, this is Negro mystic rhetoric. The South is not a nurturing place as a structural society of capitalist domination.
But obviously black people didn't think the North was. Why do you think there was all of these riots in the North? The Watts riot, riots in Chicago, riots in Philadelphia. There was riots all up and down the North. There historically have been. So black people never had the illusion, just trying to navigate pragmatically to enrich and better our lives in this brutal, insane, savage society. That's the real world. Now, you know, many people know I'm not all that much into this Martin King character, but let's see how Gates ascribes the meaning of King's death. So let's see what Gates has to say, and we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Dr. King was standing here with his friends. He was shot from that little window over there, those three windows, the one on the right, rimmed in white. He fell backwards here, and all this, of course, was covered with blood. And there's a famous photograph of all of his friends pointing to that little window as the place where the shot came from. And a whole movement, a 100-year-old movement, could be ended with one bullet shot from that window up there.
Okay, so once again, there's something kind of sick going on when you hear Gates. This is a professor talking about the movement collapse once the bullet hit King. This is kind of like a cult of personality type of situation. And that now that Jesus is gone, maybe our souls can't be saved. What is this? Look, much of the quote-unquote civil rights movement was in decline and in defeat. Everyone knows that a King and company had basically got defeated in their struggles in Chicago because it was a different animal. It wasn't the same form of overt, all the time, segregation. So many of the different techniques and struggles that had been somewhat successful in the North, I mean in the South, took on a whole nother form and element in the South. So many forms that were successful in the South, you know, it would take a whole nother strategy in the North. And of course, this brought up other dynamics, and other organizations were starting to get the ear of the masses, and you started to see the development of many elements of the black resistance movement take on other forms that were more widespread than quote-unquote integration and what that really means. Now, I'll get more into that in a little bit later, but let's next go into how Gates goes and talks to a colored from Tennessee who's gone from protester to protector of Sam's plantation. So let's explore that and take it from here. Check this out.
Dr. King's life ended in Memphis, but did his dream of a fully integrated America die with him? To find out, I asked the man who has spent the last 40 years fighting for racial equality in this city, the mayor of Memphis, Willie Herenton.
When I was 28 or 29 years old, I marched with Dr. King on behalf of the sanitation workers. And we wore this sign saying, I am a man. I was about 28, and I had the sign on me. Mm-hmm. The reason we had to say we were men was because of the way we were treated less than men. Mm-hmm.
After a career as an educator and a political activist, Dr. Herenton became Memphis's first black mayor. Since 1991, he served three terms in office, and now he's running for a fourth term.
Did you ever, in your wildest dreams, think that you would be the man at City Hall?
You know, obviously, I never thought that I'd be on the inside of this building as the mayor, when in the Civil Rights Movement I was outside protesting against the mayor, because Memphis was a mean-spirited city. It was similar to many other southern cities. I remember one evening a white man got on a bus and forced my mother and me to get up. We were at the middle of the bus, and he said, "Hey, girl," he said, "you know, you're not supposed to be sitting here." And my mother and I, we got up, and we sat farther in the back of the bus. I remember the separate water fountains. I remember going in the back of restaurants. I mean, you couldn't go in the front. Mm-hmm. The theaters, you had to go in the side doors, or you had to go upstairs. You couldn't go in the front of theaters. If you wanted to try on garments for size, you could not do that if you were black.
Hmm. Where were you when you heard the news that Dr. King had been shot?
Oh, man, I was driving back to the inner city of Memphis. I had my radio on to a black radio station, and then it came on. They said, "We have bad news. Dr. King was not only shot, but he has died." And I remember I was just overwhelmed, with emotion. I couldn't believe that, because I had seen him in Mason Temple. It might have been the night before, or a couple of nights, when he gave that speech that, you know, "I've been to the mountains." It was the night before. I was in the church at Mason Temple.
"Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead."
I didn't know that was going to be the last time that I'd hear him speak.
"Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land."
There was no other human figure like Dr. Martin Luther King. He moved the conscience of America. And all of a sudden, he's assassinated in our city, in Memphis. This is the city where I was born. Now, this event could have occurred in any American city, but it occurred in Memphis. So,
okay, so now we get into some of the heart of what I'm talking about as far as... In my opinion, Gates is kind of manipulative in some ways, or in many ways, actually. And what's going on is that he's doing the kind of quote-unquote examination of King's dream of racial integration. But it's just put on that platonic level without examining the aspect of what black people are integrating into, for example. See, part of the reason there has been and was a fostered a split in the consciousness of element of the black masses during the 60s is because as Malcolm and others were developing, Malcolm started on a line of human rights. And that started to be very critical of the role and policy of the U.S. Empire, and started to question what role the U.S. Empire is having on the world. So many black people of the time started to also question the role of the U.S. and the role of capitalism and imperialism. Because Malcolm was one of the first human rights leaders in America at the time to critique and criticize Sam's role in places like Vietnam. You know, he was doing that in the mid and early 60s. This is well before King later came out in 68. Malcolm was criticizing, and see, much of the civil rights movement dynamic, and it does have a certain element of a class dynamic within the black working class, their role was primarily to integrate into American society. Let me in, massa. Let me in. That's it. You know, where the core of black folks, especially in urban areas, who had been somewhat already more integrated in, the aspect of living in the North, you didn't see the same signs. In some cases, you would go to school where, you know, whites had been, you know, went to school, et cetera, et cetera. The situation was a little bit more critical and developed into a critique of the policies of the U.S. and saying, is this something as a system that we want to integrate into unconditionally? And there you see the hallmark of the dynamics of the split and some of the elements that later became called the Black Liberation Movement. In other words, if someone is an imperialist and has an imperialist system, do we as a people want to unconditionally just want to integrate into the system and have positions like a Colin Powell? What does that mean for black people to be a Colin Powell, you know, a general in a system that is wreaking havoc on the world? We end up basically, in essence, being the same type of person and playing the same type of role that we criticize Bull Connor of being. Colin Powell is an international Bull Connor. So Gates, though, does not want to address this aspect, and he does not want black people to address that element. All he wants to do is talk on a platonic level as far as how have we integrated into the system. And he brings up like this particular mayor who at one time was a protester, but now he's a mayor. But what does that mean for the masses? We've had black mayors all throughout. We've had black mayors from Oakland to Mississippi. What does that mean for the condition overall of black people and the role that black people make in our own overall struggle? And without examining that and thinking that just because some Negro now has a top hat on a piece of a masses plantation, that's somehow liberation, that's an illusion. The Jim Crow system was very similar to the apartheid system in South Africa. Jim Crow and apartheid are both like scaffolding. White supremacy uses scaffolding to build the house of inequality. Once the house of inequality is built, in other words, once whites are in dominant control of corporations, of water systems, of industry, in other words, of the core fabric of the capitalist system, then you can take scaffolding down because the house of inequality still stands strong. So the fact that Jim Crowism were dismantled is similar to how apartheid system as we know it, which is overt forms of segregation and barring black people from being involved in certain elements of business and this and that, the fact that those things were dismantled does not mean that black oppression was or is going to be dismantled. Because look at South Africa. Before the end of apartheid, black white people were 5% of the population. They own over 80% of the land, the best land. After apartheid, white people are 4 to 5% of the population. White people own and control over 80% of the land. In other words, they still control and own it, but they use the apartheid system as a mechanism to regiment their control and dominance in the market system. So this whole thing of just talking about the dismantling of Jim Crowism and getting particular positions on masses plantation without analyzing how from South Africa, now they're privatizing the water, and one brother recently went to jail because he stole a cup of water. Quote unquote, he stole a cup. of some dam water in South Africa, his native land. But now it's controlled. Now it's privatized because that's how the market system works. But we see the same things happening here. So what does it mean for black people in Mississippi that the Mississippi River is starting to collapse because of the eco-destruction and has a massive dead zone in it? Without critiquing the system itself, then basically you're just tap dancing in fairy tale land. Now, the colored mayor mentioned that, back in the 60s, we were treated less than men. Look, under this market system, the masses of people have always traditionally been treated less than men. Before the Civil War, white folks, less than 5% of white folks in the South could read. Now, that basically tells you there that the privatized engineering of economic control by the white slaveocracy class really didn't care about the masses of white folks. So the masses of white folks were in dire poverty themselves. Actually, after the Civil War, white literacy went up over 20%. So black participation in crushing the South actually helped liberate white folks. So what I'm saying is, in this whole market system, all the people in the working class are treated less than men and women, but there are specialized people who have been completely subhumanized. Black folks and Indians who lived in the South before they were what? Exterminated. So one could say that they were beyond treated less than human. So, and it was all in an effort of the development of the market system in the South. Now, so this is why rhetoric about, how the colored mayor saying King moved the consciousness of America and all of this kind of, symbolic, rosy stuff. Look, black folks were organized. Black folks had a tradition of organizing. After World War II, you had a social dynamic and current that gave black people more confidence to shift in more momentum. Historically, black people have been the most organized sector of the of people in America. Black people belong to some kind of organization, whether it was connected to the church or some workplace, et cetera, et cetera, because in part our survival depended on it. So it allowed us to move as a strong social force. And King became an important voice in that force. But what moved the conscience, quote unquote, of America basically was the realization that, one, they could no longer do what they had been doing without creating more trouble and havoc. And two, on a certain level, they didn't need to maintain rigid Jim Crowism. It had played its purpose in the South. Black people in many ways were ostracized and isolated in the North, which is why you saw so many riots back then, but it didn't have the same form of Jim Crowism. So as a matter of fact, like I said before, in many places you had blacks go to the same school as whites in the North. So this is what I mean by, getting into this whole bit about, we couldn't try on certain garments and we, had to drink it separate, drinking water and all of that. This is more symbolic than anything else. I mean, it's a warped mentality. But right now, today, it wasn't that many years ago. We're talking less than 5 or 6 years ago when Denny's restaurant had to pay out millions of dollars to black people all over the country, from San Jose to, Alabama, because they had it encoded to discriminate specifically against black people, either not serve them or make them pay a cover charge, et cetera, et cetera.